Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and in this episode, we propose you a full lecture about the future of globalization by Dani Rodrik, who is professor of international political economy at the John Kennedy School of Government of the Harvard University. Rodrik argues that the model of hyper-globalization we have been pursuing is unsustainable and that we have an opportunity to embark on a sounder, healthier globalization. And he outlines his views on what such a globalization might look like. The lecture took place during the Bruegel annual meetings, and it was followed by a lively discussion between Dani Rodrik and André Sapir, who is senior fellow here at Bruegel. And we have recorded and included the conversation in this podcast. Enjoy the listening.
Thank you to Bruegel for the invitation. It's very nice to be here virtually. And I really look forward to the discussion that we'll have with you, André. And I guess if there is one thing that perhaps I'd like you to take from my presentation is that we should view globalization not just as one thing, that there are many, many different globalizations. There are many questions that we need to answer, and depending on how we answer those questions, we're in fact going to get different kinds of globalization, some that are more inclusive, more conducive to stability and prosperity than others. But at the minimum, we have to answer questions like, what is the scope of globalization? Or to use the terms of my colleague, Robert Lawrence, do we want deep or shallow integration of national markets, or which market should be integrated deeply, which should be more shallowly connected? What should be the rules that underpin markets? And ultimately, who is going to decide on those rules? And what I want to illustrate in my comments is how, depending on how we're answering these kinds of questions, we are going to be getting different models of globalization. And if we are willing to make that leap to thinking about different kinds of models of globalization, different globalizations, then we can start thinking not in terms of more or less globalization, or do we give up on globalization, or do we embrace it, but we start thinking about the kinds of globalization that we do want to have. And I'll present you my views on the kinds of globalization that I'd like to see. But I want to go back to basics and ask, since we're asking big questions about the design of globalization, I want to go back and ask sort of, how can we have markets? So we know, even back from Adam Smith, who made as good a case for free markets as anybody has since then, we know from then that markets always require rules and regulations, that markets are not self-creating, they're not self-regulating, they're not self-sustaining. And Adam Smith talked about the need for a tolerable administration of justice, or what perhaps today we might call sort of things like property rights or contract enforcement and rule of law. And indeed, the classical liberal variant of a market economy or market capitalism is one where there was a relatively thin veneer of rules, but at a very minimum, you needed those rules like enforcement of property rights, enforcement of contracts, contract law, and certain degree of predictability in the administration of justice and enforcement of rules, the rule of law. Now, over time, if that was sort of, if you will, the classical liberal variant of capitalism, what in many places, and Europe, of course, has taken the lead here, is we've had variant of market capitalism that has had a much more extensive, much sort of deeper set of rules. And we might call this perhaps the social democratic variant of a market economy, where we extend, where we go beyond the sort of the minimal requirements of maintaining markets, that we go much further in terms of making those market outcomes compatible with broader social preferences, social justice, equity, fairness. And so the social democratic variant adds on property rights, contract enforcement, rule of law, sort of additional rules and regulations with respect to the provision of social rights, provision of labor protections, taxation and other measures for the provision of redistribution, wide range of public goods, and so forth. Yeah. So we know all of this in terms of what we need markets to function domestically. But we're talking about globalization, and therefore we're talking about the possibility or the shape that global markets should take. And so there's a question mark here. A question has to do whether we can have essentially the global equivalent of those domestic markets. And by analogy, if we were going to have global markets and integrated markets that no difference between, so where national borders don't make much of a difference, then we would need to have sort of global rules and regulations to uphold those markets. Now, if your view of the kind of market economy you want aligns still with the classical liberal variant, which is that all you need for markets to function well are sort of these property rights, contract enforcement, rule of law, the minimal requirement for the efficient functioning of markets, and the presumption that market failures are very few and far in between, so that you don't actually need much more, or that you don't have particularly distributive or social objectives. If that's your view of what markets actually require, then the good news is that you can indeed have global markets. Going back to, if you will, to the very first model of globalization, the classical gold standard between, let's say, 1880 and 1914, was a model of globalization where we essentially had globalization married to a set of institutions that reflected the classical liberal understanding of a thin veneer of rules. So in that view, all you needed to do is basically ensure that governments and borrowers paid their debt back, that contracts were sacrosanct, and if debts were not being paid, then one of the metropolitan powers would send the gunboats over to you to make sure that those debt contracts would be enforced. But things get more complicated. If we talk about sort of the social democratic variant understanding of the rules and regulations that uphold markets, because when we think about where that social democratic variant comes from, it comes from essentially the deepening of democratic accountability in our societies, that the reason that the classical liberal variant, Manchester liberalism, if you will, disappeared, is that we had the expansion of the franchise, the creation of a mass labor movement, the rise of a mass media, the institutionalization of politics, the spread of democratic accountability. And what that means is that with democratic accountability, with decision-making, rule-making being responsible to a wider and broader group of stakeholders, that means that essentially we also leave the shape those rules and regulations takes up to the preferences, the decision-making of the electorates or domestic stakeholders. What that means is that the moment we have democratic accountability for rulemaking, we need to talk about democracies choosing their own variant of the rules and regulations that uphold markets. So even within the social democratic variant, we have different nations deciding on very different labor market rules, different social protections, different industrial policy regimes, different tax regimes, and so forth. So democratic accountability implies democratic experimentation. It implies diversity. It implies that there is not going to be a single set of rules and regulations that can uphold global markets. What does that imply for the feasibility of global markets with that richer understanding of the rules that are required? Well, you know, one possibility is essentially that we give up on democratic accountability in favor of trying to enshrine global markets. The other possibility is that we actually enshrine democratic accountability because we understand that set of domestic economic regulations and rules that are responsive to domestic polities are necessarily going to impose, because of institutional differences and differences in rules, they're going to impose transactions costs on international trade and international finance, and therefore we cannot get deep economic integration. So this is essentially what I've called the political trilemma of the world economy a number of years ago, that the notion that there was a deep inconsistency or tension between deepening democratic accountability at home and deepening economic integration globally, a dilemma that can only be overcome, if you will, by transcending the nation state, that is, that moving from the nation state as the primary locus of sovereignty to something that might be more sort of a global quasi federalism, or in the case of the European Union, perhaps the deepening the fiscal and political union within Europe. I think this trilemma is real. It's a theoretical or conceptual construct, but it is a real one. And I think it bites in everyday life in a number of different domains. In trade, it bites in concerns about fair trade and labor and social models, in race to the bottom, the concern about social dumping. In foreign investment, it bites over questions like tax competition, the shift of the tax burden from corporation to labor that has happened, concerns about technological piracy or undermining of national security through foreign investment from companies from China or elsewhere. In finance, of course, it shows itself in financial crisis. The absence of a global regulator, global lender of last resort, means that we have more financial crises and they're more costly. The response in austerity, the presence of tax havens, of course. And in migration and labor flows, it shows up when it is not based exclusively in a kind of a ethno-nationalistic or xenophobic attitudes, when it's grounded on economic concerns, it shows up in concerns about things like regulatory arbitrage and possible adverse impacts on the welfare state of having too many migrant workers. I think, you know, the trilemma gives us a bit of an insight to the populist backlash against globalization, which in some ways mirrors the backlash that we had against the late 19th century, the gold standard version of globalization, that was also rooted in the economic anxieties and economic burdens that many parts of the economy were facing under the rules of the gold standard. But under the current version, when I was talking about some years ago about this trilemma and how it applied or it might have applied to Europe, I remember a former finance minister from the Eurozone standing up and essentially saying, well, that's the reason the populists are winning. The populists are winning because they're the only ones telling the truth about the trilemma. Now, what does that mean? It means that basically centrist political leaders, the centrist political establishment, have for a very long time essentially refused to acknowledge these constraints, that you could maintain that you could eat your cake and have it too. That is to say that on the one hand, you could maintain your sovereignty and democracy. On the other hand, you could deepen economic integration. Whereas populists have been very clear and upfront about their preference for national sovereignty. Now, it turns out that most populists in Europe and also in the American version, this preference for national sovereignty has been matched with a typically nativist right-wing authoritarian domestic agenda. But I think it's entirely possible that it could also be matched with a progressive or inclusive agenda as well. And I think historically, the American progressive tradition or American populism, which ultimately I think shows up in a different way in the New Deal of Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1930s, is an example of a much more progressive, inclusive reaction to globalization. You have to remember FDR, one of the first things he does is, of course, take the United States out of the gold standard so he could have a free hand with managing domestic monetary policy and reflate the economy at home. Now, all of this is a really backward looking, but I think it's important in terms of framing how we would think about a future global order. What I've argued is that the kind of hyper-globalization that has marked the kind of globalization we've had since the 1990s is essentially incompatible with democratic accountability because national sovereignty, or what one might call a desire to be different, desire to have your own regulatory social models and industrial models, and that might differ from those from your trade or financial partners, that is unlikely to dissipate. And here's where I come to underscore that in fact there are different globalizations, and historically there are at least three different kinds of globalizations that we have experienced. I've already mentioned the gold standard. I've mentioned the post-1990 model of hyper-globalization. The one that I did not mention, and I think it's very important because that's where I want to end my remarks, really, as I point to the future, is what might call the sort of the Bretton Woods regime, the globalization that we had, let's say, between 1945, and I would actually extend the Bretton Woods regime into the end of the 1980s. Although very specific currency arrangements already had collapsed by the late 70s. Now, as I've indicated here, and as I think made clear in my comments, that one respect in which the post-1990 hyper-globalization was similar to the gold standard is that the rules of the global market reached much more behind the borders, that there were global rules that essentially prevented domestic policymakers from doing certain things and responding adequately to domestic stakeholders. And that, of course, is the primary complaint about the post-1990 hyper-globalization as well. The Bretton Woods regime, by contrast, is the one that did not make such demands on domestic policy autonomy. It did not, the global rules enshrined, whether under sort of the GATT regime or under the IMF, were a relatively thin set of rules that were restricted to barriers at the border, quantitative restrictions or import tariffs, and with respect to macroeconomic and financial management, left a lot of room for domestic economic policymakers. Capital controls, after all, were supposed to be, according to Keynes himself back in 1944, a permanent feature of the Bretton Woods regime, so it would leave room for the domestic macroeconomic management of domestic monetary and fiscal authorities. Now, you might look at the Bretton Woods and say, well, you know, compared to the gold standard and the post-1990 model of globalization, maybe you might say that was such a shallow model of globalization, there were so thin rules that we may not even want to call it globalization. But the fact is that in terms of where it mattered, the Bretton Woods regime was in fact extraordinarily successful, not just in terms of raising incomes around the world, but in terms actually sort of in terms of the volumes of long-term investment and volumes of world trade. So here I have just three indicators. One is the volume of world trade, and I compare the period from 1950 to 1990, the Bretton Woods regime, taking out the first 5 years after the Second World War, because I don't want these growth rates to be influenced by the initial bounce back from the end of the World War. But even if we do that, we can see in the context of world trade, for example, that somewhat surprisingly, perhaps, world trade expanded much more rapidly under Bretton Woods than it did in the post-1990 hyper-globalization model. World GDP on the whole was sort of performance was similar. When we look at some of the key countries in the world, most European countries actually, and many developing countries, here, you know, my indicator for a European country is France. It would not have been very different if I had included Belgium instead of France. But the point was that there was, you know, growth rates were in fact higher under that earlier regime. Now, this is a paradox only superficially. The superficial paradox being that both incomes and globalization levels might have advanced more rapidly under a less restrictive, globalization or less deep globalization regime. But I think I interpret this as essentially as vindication of the idea that a sound globalization has to leave enough room for domestic economic management and domestic bargains to be struck between sort of different social partners that allow sort of inclusive prosperity within individual countries. And then if you allow that inclusive prosperity to proceed, then countries, in fact, are more likely to welcome trade and investment because they have less to fear from the economic anxieties that integration to the world market might create. So it's what that means, I think, for the future, or my preferred future, globalization, is that, you know, I believe we need to return to the spirit, if not the actual practices of the Bretton Woods period. So I don't mean let's return to, you know, necessarily widespread capital controls, let's return to fixed exchange rates, and let's return back to widespread quantitative restrictions. But I do think that we need to return to a kind of a thinner model of globalization that's going to be also more sustainable. That's going to require new traffic rules for the world economy. In general, much greater policy space for both developed and developing nations. And a recognition and acknowledgement that regulatory diversity, whether it's in subsidies, in industrial policy, intellectual property areas, sanitary standards, product regulations, financial regulations, that regulatory diversity is for the most part a good thing, that we need to trade off the gains from trade that we get from eliminating regulatory diversity and establishing regulatory harmonization against the losses from giving up on regulatory diversity and being more responsive to national demands. I think what that means for developed countries, advanced countries in particular, is that we need a system that's going to give priority to reconstituting social contracts at home. That's going to require a variety of policies and tax regimes and social policies in environment, in innovation regimes, and the labor markets to support in a green and what I would call a good jobs economy. I think the trouble, many of our political and social troubles today originate from this middle class squeeze, from the disappearance of good jobs, a kind of labor market polarization. And that's going to require a largely domestic policy agenda. I think what international and financial rules can do here is rather limited, except for providing room for those policies to be implemented. And I think the domestic trade and financial rules ought to provide protection for the home economy only to the extent that it is necessary to prevent regulatory arbitrage that would undermine those domestic institutional and regulatory choices. So that might mean, for example, rules, domestic trade policies that provide room against or provide protection against social dumping for countries that are greening up and decarbonizing their economies, carbon border taxes, again, for the purpose of ensuring domestic decarbonization policies are not undermined. a management of capital flows to the extent that those undermine and complicate macroeconomic policies. Restrictions on inward foreign investment, partly with regard to China, when national security considerations become paramount. But the point is that such protections would be in the service of a domestic economic agenda. It's only when there is a sound, coherent domestic agenda that it's worth protecting them through these border kinds of policies. But it's important to put the priorities on what we need to do at home and to think about our external policies as being an adjunct to what we need to do at home, as opposed to what I think has been the defining feature of policies in the last 40 years, which is essentially what is it that we need to do at home in order to maintain openness or be better competitors globally. I think the final thing I want to say is with regard to China, because I think China is going to be the key issue going forward. And I think what we have learned is that China is perhaps the most extreme example of the infeasibility of a model of deep integration. And so we're not going to be able to go back to a model where we can expect China to comply with the kinds of WTO norms that we thought, I think misleadingly, that China would. I think that presumes a change in the Chinese economic system that's simply not going to happen. And given that we're talking about the economy that has engineered the most remarkable poverty reduction experience ever in economic history, I think we should cut them some slack about the kind of economic regime or system that they want. At the same time, I think decoupling is not desirable. I think that would come at too big a cost, and I think too many economic linkages have been built for decoupling to be desirable. So I think what I was saying before about a kind of a thinner globalization in the case of China, I think translates into a model of what one might call peaceful economic coexistence. That is that that the West and the United States in particular understand that China can and will maintain its own industrial and intellectual property and state-owned enterprise policies, while Europe and the United States remain free to uphold their social standards and innovation systems. And I think a system like that would still allow reaping the bulk of the gains from trade while ensuring that both sets of countries have the space to maintain, develop distinct economic systems. I think that was largely the spirit of the GATT regime. It was largely the spirit of the three or four decades after the Second World War. And I think that's where in my view, a desirable direction for the future of globalization would be. I think that's clearly not the only path that we can see many disastrous paths, and I think a mindless attempt to decouple, as the Trump administration has been pursuing, I think is quite quite dangerous. But I think it's also the presumption that we could sort of return to a kind of post 1990 hyperglobalization model, I think, is also going to very likely backfire as well. And so the point is not to give up on globalization. I think the point is to erect it on sounder principles, recognizing that we live in a world with very diverse economic systems and economic regimes and diverse understandings of social models. And I think that's going to it is going to require putting some sand in the wheels of not just international finance, but often international trade and global supply chains as well. And I think that if we recognize that, we can build around it rather than acting it's a complete aberration, and therefore recognizing that reality. So let me just I'll stop here.
Thank you. Thank you, Danny, for a very rich and very interesting presentation. Let me make some comments, if I may. I would say on the whole, it's hard to disagree with the presentation. I think the spirit of the presentation is very much one that I share. So the goals that Danny is trying to achieve, that is to keep globalization, but reduce or to make globalization in a sense feasible for a world which has changed quite a bit since it was the case 30, 40 years ago. So we can't go back, obviously, to the era of Bretton Woods. The world has changed too much. For instance, China. There was no China then. There was no, you know, there was basically no India as well. So more than half of the world was out of the picture. So we're in a different world. But yes, we would like to keep some of the features or some of the outcomes that we had in that sort of golden age after World War II and during the Bretton Woods period. And let me just sort of say, you know, what is it I get from the historical experience, and how does that relate to the presentation? And because Danny, you spoke a lot about the 1930s, Roosevelt, obviously World War II, and then what was built and did by Keynes and by his American counterparts after World War II as the Bretton Woods institutions. And so I think it's fair to say that during the war, during the Second World War, and immediately after the Second World War, the advanced economies, mostly, that created the Bretton Woods institution, did two kinds of reforms. One kind was the domestic reforms, the Roosevelt sort of New Deal reforms that were then also generalized to all of the advanced economies, the UK, Europe, each of them in their own fashion had sort of put in place a social contract. And then there was a global contract, the global institutions, right? That's what was put in place as a lesson of the 1930s and the first part of the 1940s. Domestic institutions, the social contract, and global institutions, Bretton Woods and the GATT. And that worked very well for a while. And now we are so many years later, so many things have changed, both domestically and globally. Different players, different policies, different technologies. And I think that indeed today one has to ask oneself whether both the domestic institutions and the global institutions are fit to deal with what has happened to globalization. And I think this is what you are dealing with. And I should say, and this is where I will divide my comments, I'm with you 100% on the domestic part. I'm in quite disagreement about the global part. On the domestic part, sure, we do need in our advanced economies, especially, but elsewhere also, we do need what you call a new social contract. I fully agree with that. That the social contract, for a variety of reasons, has been dismantled in different manners. Globalization may have played a role in this, but there are many, many other factors, right? And I would say that most of the factors are domestic politics and tax reforms that have occurred. There's been also obviously technological change. Many factors have occurred, but the same social contract that, you know, was good to many of our societies need to be revamped today. And so I think, and this is also the emphasis that you put, the domestic side. So I'm with you 100%. And if we don't do that, obviously, I think that globalization will be hard to sustain from the politics. You know, what you discussed about the populism. I think definitely there is something there that is very, 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 very correct. I would also agree that domestic politics and domestic policies that are key to engineer a new social contract are not enough. We also need at the international level to extend the reach of the global rules, and that needs to include taxation. So I think that indeed taxation has become a huge problem. And there is, you know, if you want the social model to be financed, you need also resources. And that means taxation. So I think, yes, the social contract, the extension of the global rules to taxation, I'm 100% with you on that. Where I depart from your view is about one of your fundamental tenets is the space, the policy space, that you think that this era of hyper-globalization, as you call it, by the way, I question very much your graph about, you know, the growth of trade and GDP before 1990 and after 1990. I have lots of questions about, you know, whether those numbers are correct. I don't think there are. But okay, let's leave that aside. What you call the period of hyper-globalization in the 1990s is essentially the fact that countries have lost policy space, right? This is what you're after. You want to give back, go back to the era of Bretton Woods when countries had greater policy space. And while I can see this issue as far as capital movement is concerned, I see it less as far as trade is concerned. And you know, I'm concerned that you didn't give us really an example of where, because of the shift from the GATT to the WTO, countries have lost the policy space that you are hankering for. Yeah, now they are prevented from doing policies, the good policies that you want and that I want as well. You know, which country is prevented from having the good social policies, from having the good climate policies that we want? How are they prevented to do that from the WTO? Let me take an example that you did not mention, but that may be a subtext there. Is any country prevented from putting in place climate policies to stop climate change, whether it's taxation? You know, in the EU, there's been much discussion, as you know, about border climate adjustment system. By all means, and all discussion I've had with trade lawyers, there's nothing in WTO rules that would prevent that. Nothing. So where are countries prevented to put in place, because of WTO rules, better social policies, better climate policies? Where? No place. So yes, it sounds great, you know, having space, but I don't think that the space has to be done politically at the domestic level. It's not because of WTO rules someplace that countries are not able to have those policies, those good policies that you and I want to have them in place. And I'm in fact rather, and you are as well, I suppose, questioned by the fact that, you know, the one country that is questioning the most the WTO rules at the moment, the United States, it's not doing that exactly because they want policy space for better social policies or better environmental policies. This is completely different. And I'm also remarking on the fact that weaker countries that need international rules, you know, the strong countries like the United States, We know the rule of the jungle, you know, the strong ones, they don't need rules, right? It's the weak ones that need rules. So I'm worried that your discourse about the WTO rules being anti-weaker countries and weaker people in terms of, you know, the policy space that they need, that in fact is doing the other way around. Weakening the WTO is strengthening the strong countries at the expense of the weak countries. That's my first point about the policy space. My last point about the policy space is about China. I agree with you again about the vision. And the vision that you expressed is peaceful economic coexistence between China and the rest of the countries, including the West, including the advanced economies. And I share with you the view that, you know, we, for quite a while now, we should give up on the idea that there's going to be a regime change in China. Maybe we'd hope that to happen when China joined the WTO in 2001, but in 2020, we don't see that in the horizon. So we need a system, indeed, we need a global system where there is space for countries, for China and for others to have what you call this peaceful economic coexistence. So fully agree with you. But you know, Petros Mavroidis and myself, we have just finished a book called China and the WTO that will be published in the near future by Princeton University Press that precisely discuss those matters. And we come to a very different conclusion than you do. You know, we don't come to the conclusion that, you know, we should go back to the GATT rules, the TINER rules. We say, no, WTO rules need to be changed to some extent. And they need to be changed not with respect to China to engineer a regime change in China, but to engineer some behavioral change in some dimensions. Because, you know, when you speak of policy space for a country like China, that has now become the largest exporter in the world, the second largest economy in the world, there, I think there is a real danger that if we do not change some WTO rules, not again to force China to change regime, but to force China and other countries to change their behavior in some dimensions, in only some dimensions, those dimensions that are indeed not compatible with the functioning of a global system, then we will not have WTO rules, we will not have GATT rules, we will destroy the system altogether. So I think there is a real difference between us.
Thank you, Andre, for those comments. I look forward to your piece on China, and maybe I doubt we'll have time to discuss that at length. Sure. Too. But let me go straight into, I think, is what is probably the greatest disagreement is on this notion of policy space, because for me it is important, and you were rather dismissive. I think it's important to understand where the constraints really come from. The constraints actually don't come necessarily from specific WTO rules or specific agreements. The constraints are really cognitive. It's the constraints are in the minds of the domestic policymakers in terms of how they think the rules, what do they think the rules of the game are. And let me give you a very, you know, immediate example here, historical example. We've talked about the gold standard. We can agree that there was actually no external constraint in the gold standard, in the sense that there was no international agreement that made any country peg their currency to the gold. And certainly for any large country like the United States, no international constraint that would prevent them from servicing their debt contracts in gold. But the constraint was in the perceived rules of the game as the domestic policymakers followed them. And so there was a rules of the game, and it was in the constraints. And even though there was no external enforcer, The system imposes constraints on what individual countries think it is proper to do, what they need to do. Now, in the post-90 world, after in a post-WTO world, of course, you know, some of them have been codified in the form of actual WTO agreements or trade agreements or rules with respect to capital flows in the OECD and so forth. But that's only a subset of the rules as they existed. To find where the constraints and the lack of policy space exist, you actually have to go and look at what policymakers were doing and saying. I'll actually give you a specific example about that's particularly germane about actually existing written down rules. But I think the broader issue is the kind of, you know, sort of when, a quote that comes to mind is Tony Blair back in 2005, you know, defending globalization by saying, you know, I hear people say we have to stop and debate globalization. And he says, you might as well debate whether autumn should follow summer, right? So it's a given, and you should, you know, just stop complaining and do what globalization requires you to do. It's an inversion of the policy priorities of the Bretton Woods period, where the global economy under the Bretton Woods were supposed to be in the service of domestic economic and social objectives, including full employment. After the 1990s, as this quote from Blair indicates, it became that the domestic economy became in the service of an open global economy. But let me get more concrete and give you, you asked for an example. Let me compare, let's compare the 1980s and the 2000s in the way that U.S. trade policy reacted to what was then the dominant import surge and threat. In the 1980s, it was Japan. In the 2000s, it was China. Now, in the 1980s, even though we had in the U.S. a free trader president, Reagan, Reagan responded to many of the, sort of social conflicts and distributional conflicts that were generated by the Japanese export surge by putting in place voluntary export restraints. And you'll remember, Andrew, very well that was when we started talking about the new protectionism, right? And a lot of people really became very worried that this might be, sort of globalization was going off track. Now, there was nothing in the rules then, because the WTO had not yet come into effect, that really prevented countries from doing, WTO, doing these VERs. In fact, they would be subsequently banned in the WTO. But that was an example of the kinds of thing. Now, VERs, many trade economists thought was a terrible thing. In fact, they were an act of system maintenance, because they were a way in which importing countries, the United States, but also European countries, were able to manage deals with Japan to provide for temporary protection for some important sectors, while essentially bribing on the side the Japanese exporters, because they would keep the quota rents. And even though it looked like it was a derogation from the ideal rules that trade economists might want to have, this was perfectly okay, and they did it, right? And this is what saved, the trade regime in the 1980s, to the extent that you could act then in the 1990s launch into this sort of big leap into hyper-globalization. So far from upsetting or dismantling globalization, this temporary respite, this temporary protectionism, this act of being able to pull up these barriers domestically, in fact, saved the regime. Now we go to 2000s. Now the rules are very different, but again, mostly it's not because the WTO banned VERs or other unilateral protections. In fact, there were things that the U.S. administration in the 2000 could do that were as part of what has been negotiated with China, as part of China's accession. But because the 2000s understanding of the rules of the game was the Blair understanding or the Clinton understanding that, globalization is a force of nature, there's nothing you can do to it. As much, you can't, affect the hurricane, you can't affect globalization, so you just have to, basically grin and bear with it. There was essentially very little done to protect communities in the 2000s that were very adversely affected by the China trade shock. And now we have, of course, we have very detailed, very well done empirical studies that show not only that the economically devastating impact of this shock in particular communities in the United States, perhaps more importantly for our conversation, we have evidence that they were behind the support for Trump and the far right in the United States, and also similar studies have shown similar consequences for Europe as well.
If I can abuse the time, I think that is a question that all of us need to ask ourselves, and I've asked myself many times, and I don't have an answer, and I'm really curious. I don't think there is a answer, so I'm really curious to hear your answer. When you speak to the and I'm saying that in a positive manner now, when you speak of the Bretton Woods era, right, in a very positive manner, right, this is your preferred of the three regimes. Right? This is your preferred regime. Now, we have to remember that Bretton Woods, now if we look in geopolitical terms, this is a world where the US is very much the dominant power. And as I said before, more than half of the world population is completely outside of the system. It's not globalization. Right, it's the West and the offshoots of the West. There's no China there. There's obviously no Soviet Union and all the Soviet bloc. And India, yes, India is there, but really on the back burner. Right, it's not an active participant. It's sort of a passive participant in this system. It's really Europe and the United States. And then some developing countries that are participating, and Korea and Hong Kong and Singapore and Taiwan that start to play. But that's the state of the world before 1989, right? And then your 1990, your hyper-globalization, there's a huge change in politics, right? This is post 1989. This is post 1989 in Europe, and this is post 1989 also in China, in a sense, after Tiananmen and all of the changes there. So we're in a completely different geopolitical world. And so I think one question that I think many political scientists write about this, but your view is interesting on this. You want to go back to Bretton Woods on the rules of the game, but geopolitics has completely changed. And can we have a system, whether it's the GATT or whether it's WTO, whatever, where we have a China and a United States that are both within the system, not US and the Soviet Union, one inside and one outside? Can we have a global system, whatever that global system, shallow, even shallow, your peaceful coexistence, where you have a geopolitical competition between two rivals? And your example of Huawei is obviously one. And you give an answer, yes, okay, the US will not allow Huawei inside, but will not prevent Huawei to grow outside. Do you think that's really possible? That coexistence, or are we doomed?
Well, one or the other. I think our job is to provide an alternative that has a certain degree of plausibility, mm-hmm. that it keeps us from vacillating between a future that's a version of the past that has outlived its usefulness and that cannot be replicated, or a doomsday scenario, which we don't want to have. So I think do I feel confident that the Huawei dispute can be managed in a way that I have very briefly sketched out? Do I think that that the U.S.-China geopolitical conflict and strategic competition is not going to spill over into economic and commercial relations and therefore result in a complete decoupling. Am I confident of that? Absolutely not. But do I think that this is a foreordained conclusion? No. I mean, I think, you know, that there are alternative futures, and there are futures where I can envisage that would benefit the U.S., Europe, and China for somewhat different reasons, and therefore that they have long-term interests in making such a set of arrangements work. I think, unlike the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, I think China is much more interested on the economic side of the global economic order, because obviously it's much more integrated in the world economy than the Soviet Union ever was. So actually, and when I use the term peaceful coexistence, the analogy is precisely that in the political strategic dimension, that what enabled the United States and Soviet Union, what prevented them from going into a nuclear war, is a mutual recognition that, you know, on the part of the United States, that you know, the regime in Moscow would not disappear anytime soon, that they were there to last, and on the part of the Soviet Union, that the United States was not going to have a communist revolution anytime soon. So once you began to recognize that these were two very different political systems, that you then, you know, operated against that constraint. Now, it doesn't mean that the Cold War between the two countries politically and strategically was, you know, harmonious. I mean, they engage in all kinds of proxy wars all over the world. Okay. But we didn't have the main. We managed to avoid the key thing. We avoided nuclear war. The analogy on the economic dimension is that the United States and the West have to recognize that the Chinese economic system is very different and will remain different. And therefore, the kind of trade integration in terms of common set of rules that the WTO regime was predicated on. And if I understood correctly, your summary of your work with Mavroidis is predicated on is not feasible. It presumes too much convergence in the domestic management of these economies in terms of rules on state ownership, subsidies, intellectual property rights, industrial policies, and so forth. So once we realize that that convergence isn't going to happen, the question is, can we still make a world, you know, that reaps significant amount of gains of trade, but, you know, is still a stable order? And I think I'm appealing then to the Bretton Woods regime, because that was a version of an order like that. Now, you say that, you know, the most of the world wasn't included in there, but that's not quite true. I mean, you know, more countries grew more rapidly under Bretton Woods than under post-1990 globalization. The chief exception to that is China. And how did China...
In terms of weight of population...
As a good example of trade integration or integration into financial systems, neither China nor India played the globalization role by the post-1990 conception of what they were supposed to be. China, which is by far the most successful example of that, you know, sort of actually is the chief example of a country that played globalization by Bretton Woods rules, because it had trade protection, because it had subsidies, because it had its own industrial policies and intellectual property rights. It managed capital flows, it manages currency. But what are those rules? They are Bretton Woods rules. Now, it is a fact that they free rode on the rest of on other countries' openness. But in terms of their own economic policies, which is basically 80% of their success is their own economic policies, now they were Bretton Woods rules. So I think, you know, even the chief successes of the post-1990 order are essentially grounded in a very different understanding of what those global rules ought to be.
All right, let's agree to disagree on that point. But I think we very much agree, and I very much agree with you that the issue of peaceful coexistence between China, the United States, Europe, and the world in general is really the major topic of the next decades of today and of the next decades, and how to reconcile the economic interest and the geopolitical interests, and indeed find that path, maybe a narrow path, that will avoid the two pitfalls that you have well painted for us, and you know, seek this more harmonious future, harmonious in political terms and harmonious in economic terms, is indeed what all of us need to work on. And I'm very grateful for all the work that you are doing in this space, and for the time that you devoted to us to engage into this very interesting conversation.
Thank you, André. Take care.
Bye. You too.
Thanks for listening to The Sound of Economics. This was a lecture by Professor Danny Roderick about the future of globalization and the conversation that he had with our senior fellow André Sapir. For more insights and research from our scholars, you can visit the Bruegel website on www.bruegel.org. Until next time, bye-bye.